From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
It was one of the most highly anticipated meetings of the decade.
President Putin and I have been discussing various things, and I think it's going very well. We've had some very, very good talks.
President Trump's optimism was shared by the Russian president.
I'm delighted to be able to meet you personally, Mr. President, and I hope, as you have said, our meeting will yield positive results.
But rather than focus on the results of the meeting, tangible things like perhaps better prospects for peace in Syria, the U.S. media and much of the U.S. Congress has focused instead on a meeting that took place last year between the president's son and a Russian lawyer. For more on that, we spoke with Dmitry Babich of Sputnik News Agency based in Moscow via Skype Friday. Dmitry, it's been a very, very busy week or two. Let's dive in.
Well, it's true. We had G20. We had a series of visits of U.S. and EU officials to Ukraine. All of them, saying incredibly stupid things about the civil war there, saying that it was Russia's aggression, basically praising the regime in Kiev, but at the same time not promising any substantial economic aid. So it was funny, when the head of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, when he came to Kiev, he said, let me quote, "During the three last years, more has been done for the European integration of Ukraine than in all the previous years of Ukrainian independence," end of quote. Well, the problem is that Ukrainian exports to the European Union fell by 36% during these 3 years. This is something that had never happened, even when the Soviet Union collapsed, and because Ukraine was a part of the same economic space with the Soviet Union and previously Russian Empire for 300 years. Of course, there was a slump in production, and there was a slump in exports, but nothing like the disaster that they have now. So it's just amazing. It's a theater of absurd, European officials praising this regime as some kind of an achievement for Ukraine. The other things were equally hypocritical and I would say absurd. The last absurdity came from the French president, Emmanuel Macron. He invited Donald Trump to Paris. And we understand why Trump was happy to go. Originally, Trump wanted to visit London, but there was going to be a huge protest there. So remembering what happened in Hamburg, Trump didn't go. And it was probably a wise move from him. So Trump visited two European countries aside Germany. He visited Poland, where a very crude nationalist party is in power, and where he delivered a speech basically at the same time conservative and very anti-Russian. So he catered to the audience there, they applauded. And now he is visiting France simply because the current French president, Emmanuel Macron, has just won the election, which the globalist elites feared could be won by Marine Le Pen or some other alternative figure. So he's basking in his glory and he can invite anyone. And he invited Trump and used Trump's visit to say that France no longer insisted on Mr. Assad's leaving power, no longer insisted on it as a precondition for the Syrian settlement. Well, the problem is, if we look at it from the point of view of international law, who is Macron to decide, whether President Assad of Syria should step down or should stay? Right. Historically, France was a colonial power in Syria. That's they right. let Syria go only in 1946 after decades of armed fight, in which right. tens of thousands of Syrians died. So,
and France has been
has no right to lecture Syria, that is France.
Right, and France has been resurging as a colonial power, for example, carting off the president of Cote d'Ivoire at gunpoint from the presidential palace and also going into Mali at the invitation of the United States, etc.
Absolutely, and in Africa, of course, this is seen in a very bad light, bearing in mind the abysmal French colonial history in the right. countries like Algiers, right. In the countries like Morocco, in the countries like Mali and Côte d'Ivoire. In Côte d'Ivoire, in fact, you know, when they say France helped the democratically elected president, well, that president came in the, you know, in the trucks of the invading French army.
Right.
They joked in the 19th century that any head of state that came with the wagons of the invading foreign army is not a very reliable head of state.
Right.
That, you know, the only change is that this time trucks were used and not
right.
wagons,
motorized,
you know,
right.
pulled by oxes or by horses.
They may even have had GPSs at this point with the modern technology.
But let me add something that our listeners may not know. It's not just that from the point of view of international law, France has no right to decide for Syria whether Mr. Assad should stay in power or not. And let me remind you that President Hollande already made a similar statement almost 2 years ago after the terrorist act in Paris, right. when the enemies of Mr. Assad killed a few dozen French people and held the city hostage for the whole night, you know, that infamous Bataclan attack. So 2 weeks after Bataclan, the French President Hollande said that, you know, we are not intent on chasing Mr. Assad out of power. Our main enemy is the so-called Islamic State. And then in 2 weeks, he returned to his previous ways right. as if nothing happened. And please note that whenever a terrorist act happens in Paris or in Brussels, or in the United States for that matter, no one ever suspects Assad. It's always Assad's enemies who
right.
do it. You know,
right.
the Islamic State or some other Islamist organization, Al-Qaeda or Jabhat al-Nusra, they are the terrorist apparatus in Europe and in other Western countries. But somehow, after the terrorist act is forgotten, the Western countries always return to their previous policy of viewing the Syrian government and Mr. Assad as the villain number one, you know, in Syria. With France, the whole thing is especially stinky because of the personal history. You know, President Assad tried to be friends with the previous French president, Nicolas Sarkozy.
Yeah.
In 2010, right before the so-called Arab Revolution, you know, Assad visited France. He was taking part in the parade on Champs-Élysées on the 14th of July, just the same as doing the same thing that Trump is doing now.
Right.
And on Christmas, in a few months, Assad and his wife Asma visited Paris. That was reported by the journalists of Le Figaro. You know, the atmosphere was very cordial. There were presents exchanged. And then in 3 months, basically, Sarkozy wanted to see Mr. Assad killed together with the wife and with their possible Christmas presents, you know.
Yeah, this is what he did with Gaddafi, too. Gaddafi actually supported Sarkozy, and you saw what happened to Gaddafi at that point in time.
Absolutely. He was received by Sarkozy with great honor. He was allowed to camp out, I think, right next to the Elysee Palace.
Right.
He was viewed as somewhat eccentric but a respected foreign leader, obviously with huge oil resources, you know, someone who abandoned the weapons of mass destruction. I mean, when people now look at North Korea wondering, why don't they just throw out the weapons of mass destruction? Well, they have the experience of Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi.
Right.
Both men obviously indeed destroyed their stockpiles of dangerous weapons, and look what happened to them.
Oops. it's so obvious. And, you know, okay, so you have Trump now traveling down the same road. I'm wondering if we're going to see his head roll as a consequence of, you know, taking the hero's welcome from Macron.
Well, I think that basically Americans should understand what was going on in Europe during the electoral campaign in the United States and immediately afterwards. The European media was even worse. It was even more biased than the American media. I mean, 95% of the media blasted Trump as a danger to mankind, as a very bad person, a huge threat to humanity. They were all pro-Clinton. They all said that Hillary was exactly, you know, the person we need in the White House. So this demonization of Trump, I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't concede that Trump a smart person or an honest person by any means, but the methods that were used against him in the United States and in the EU, I think they were lethal for democracy because, look, I think that Obama indeed will go down in history as the president who destroyed very important American institutions. Yeah. He destroyed the institution of honest election. Never in American history, never did an acting president not only endorse the candidacy of someone from his own party, but you know the U.S. Acting U.S. presidents never blasted or criticized the candidate of the other party, and that's exactly what Obama did. And he not only blasted Trump in very insulting, humiliating terms, he did it before the G7 leaders. Right. And let me remind you that G7 leaders play, you know, the key roles in European politics. France, the UK, Germany, Italy, these are the most important European powers. Right. And their leaders were listening to this, you know, Obama basically promising them that Trump would not come to power in the United States. Yeah. Who the hell was Obama to decide who should be the next president of the United States? But they participated in this. Right. And European media participated in this. So now they have this inertia. They started a campaign of hate against Trump. And in Europe, people are sometimes even more gullible than in the United States, because in the United States, at least people knew what Hillary was worth.
Right.
People were sick and tired of wars that Hillary helped to start.
Right.
In Europe, people have a lot of people have a shorter memory. Countries like, I don't know, Italy or France, you know, they didn't go to Iraq. So basically, it was easier to induce in them that hatred for Trump, which made his visit to London and to other European capitals impossible, except Paris, Hamburg, and Warsaw.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned how people in the United States, at least, are familiar with Clinton and tired of war. There was a study that was released in May, early June, you know, an academic paper entitled Battlefield Casualties and Ballot Box Defeat. Did the Bush-Obama Wars Cost Clinton the White House? And what it does is look at particularly Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and says basically these states that had the heaviest casualties from the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, etc., that those places that had the highest casualties were the strongest votes for Donald Trump, and ties it to the, you know, the promise, whatever the promise was worth, of an end to regime change. In other words, that there's an electoral constituency out there that helped put Trump in the White House that did so over the question of war and peace because of their own personal experience of loss in these last wars. And that is part of the landscape here that, you know, they demonstrated in this study and is very well documented. And now that's got to be part of the discussion here about the political configuration inside the United States.
Well, I agree with you, but the problem is that we have seen during the recent G20 summit that Trump actually is not free in his actions. Look, he met with Putin first. The U.S. establishment did everything that this meeting should never happen. You know, it was a travesty. You know, the new president of the United States meets the president of the second biggest nuclear power only, I guess, 5 months after coming to power. That had never happened before. And we understand it was not because of Trump's unwillingness to get acquainted with Putin. It was because of the pressure from the Congress, from the media, right, from the European Union. In the European Union, they made outrageous statements like saying that Trump and Putin were a threat to European security. This is something that we heard from none other than the head of the European Council, Donald Tusk, you know, the formerly the number one person in the European Union. So basically, this demonization of both Trump and Putin, it was so strong that it prevented their meeting for 5 months. Then they met. They agreed on creating a task force on cybersecurity. I think it's a kind of a direct line, you know, the red phone that right. was established after the Cuban crisis. So right. it, of course, didn't mean that the United States would have to share any kind of secret information with Russia. It was just a way to communicate if a cyber threat arises.
Right.
And what happened? Next day, we had a hysteria in the Washington Post, in the New York Times. You know, Trump is selling out secrets to Russia. And Trump immediately caved in, saying that, I discussed it, but it doesn't mean I supported it. So he looked like basically, I mean, he was a man to be pitied in this situation, because the most terrible situation that you can find yourself in is that formally you have power, and formally you have responsibility, but you have no clout on how the events are going to develop. That's the most humiliating situation. And the other things, I mean, during his electoral campaign, Trump promised to improve relations with Russia, to get along with Putin. He promised that the United States would direct its actions in Syria against the terrorists, not against the government there. And he couldn't deliver on any of these promises. Why? I can explain you. I think people should understand, you know, the modern Western world is not a democracy. I think this is absolutely clear.
Right.
It's enough to listen to Chomsky. It's enough to look at the newspapers. It's enough to look at the last electoral campaigns in Europe and in the United States. It's not a democracy. But it also, it's not a dictatorship of persons. It's a dictatorship of an ideology. Mm. The ultra-liberal globalist ideology is not interested in strong leaders. It's not interested in personalities. Mm-hmm. It's interested in managers. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Angela Merkel of the Federal Republic of Germany, she is an absolutely faceless, duplicitous, hypocritical politician. I mean, she betrayed her benefactor, Helmut Kohl, who died recently. She attacked him immediately after he was criticized for wrong practices in his party, even though she owed her career to him. Mm-hmm. She claimed to be a friend of Russia, and then she became a motor of sanctions against Russia. She said that, things like, we respect Ukrainian sovereignty, and she was the first one to basically attack President Yanukovych simply because he used his constitutional right to postpone the signing of the treaty on the European Association for Ukraine. She supported, openly supported the Maidan rebellion against the president, which was an armed rebellion. It right. was not a peaceful protest, as the European media shamelessly stated, you know, with video pictures of dozens of policemen being burned to death, you know, that they kept saying that this was a peaceful process.
And John McCain and other American politicians calling on the crowd to uprise. I mean, they talk about Russian meddling in the U.S. election, but you had American elected officials and then State Department people like Nuland encouraging insurrection in the streets, which led to a coup.
Yeah, distributing cookies to the people who are burning tires
right.
on the streets of Kiev, you know, right. so that it was difficult to breathe. You had the German foreign minister, Westerwelle, coming and speaking to the protesters. Imagine a Russian officials coming to Washington, D.C. during the Occupy Wall Street movement and saying, hey, guys, you know, no fear.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, not a step backwards. Right. What the reaction would be from the State Department. But they forgot it all. Now they are feeding us these stories, you know, like Trump's son-in-law met with a Russian woman lawyer. How awful!
I know.
You know,
right.
And then they use the same words which they accuse the Russian media of wrongly using. You know, we had legislation against the foreign agents introduced 6 years ago, legislation that copied the American Foreign Agents Registration Act. And the American media, together with the European media, they kept saying, oh, how awful, you know, this very expression, foreign agent, it's so awful. And now we read in the New York Times about, Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. meeting a foreign agent. Why is this woman a foreign agent? She's a lawyer, and she wanted to talk to them about the adoption of Russian orphans by American families.
Right.
What a terrible agent she is.
Well, how about AIPAC, okay, which Kushner meets with all the time, and lots of other American politicians, and also various Saudi lobbying groups that actually are engaged in the business of influencing not just American elections, but the people that get elected once they get in office.
Absolutely. And the current situation when basically Saudi Arabia is waging a war on one of the poorest countries in the world, on Yemen.
Right.
And the United States is supporting it. I mean, it's a shame that Egypt supports it. But OK, I can understand Egypt. They have 85 million people to feed. Right. They have no oil and gas. That's how the colonial powers divided, the area when they left. So Egypt is very financially dependent on Saudi Arabia. They give Saudi Arabia kind of a moral support in their aggression against Yemen.
Right.
But the United States is selling them, you know, the weapons. Donald Trump sold, cut the deals on more than $100 billion, and he promised $300 billion more. Against whom?
Well, that's a year after Obama gave them $65 billion.
Absolutely. Well, in that sense, of course, Obama was the main destroyer. He destroyed the American institutions. You know, the American press during the election was anything but unbiased. It was very biased. So that institution was finally destroyed by Obama.
Yeah.
I don't know who now can refer to the Washington Post or the New York Times as reliable sources of information. That has been the case for decades.
Right.
It's not the case now. It's clear that the U.S. influence in the world and the influence of the West in general is declining, and they will probably blame Trump for that. But I think it would be wrong to blame Trump for that. I think the main destruction came from Obama. He destroyed the institution of unbiased press. I think anyone who monitored the U.S. press during the election can testify that it was not objective. It was very partisan, very biased.
Right.
And he destroyed the very institution of elections because the state was not neutral during this election.
Especially the Intel, FBI, and all of those. My God.
Awful, you know, it, and not only FBI and all of these mythical 17 security agencies, which were not 17 at all, as we now know, the acting president himself just blasting, destroying one of the candidates while endorsing the other one. That is a breach of a basic election rule, the neutrality of the state during the election.
Right. And then European leaders were doing that, too, by the way. Rather than Obama defending the American electoral system from outside interference, he was doing it in concert with the others in Europe and Japan, wherever.
Absolutely. Well,
so, yeah.
Spoke to G7 leaders in spring 2016, and he promised them that Trump would not win this election. And he did it publicly.
Right.
You know, he didn't do it at some kind of a secret meeting. You know, in 2012, it would be a scandal if at a if the press had found out that the outgoing president, you know, George Bush the Jr. or whatever, or Obama, he basically promised that Mitt Romney would not become the president, the next president of the United States. That would be seen as a scandal, and yeah, that would be a reason for impeachment.
Well, take a look at right now. They're saying that Donald Trump Jr.'s behavior in engaging with this Russian attorney, that forget whether she offered anything or not, and forget whether anything was delivered or not, it shows that he is so inclined to accept such a thing, that that's the same as the guilt. Well, Obama said basically, look, we're going to stop Trump from being president.
Absolutely.
That shows his inclination.
And the terms which the press used during its nasty attack against Jared Kushner and against Donald Trump the Jr., don't get me wrong, I don't think these people are great. They're pretty bad guys.
Treason.
Dudes, as Trump puts that. But the expressions like treason, foreign agent. For 6 years, we had the American press blasting Russia for introducing into our legislation the very expression foreign agent, even though our legislation on foreign agents was copied from the United States Foreign Agents Registration Act, adopted, I guess, in 1940.
Right.
So the European and the American press just blasted Putin and Russia for that, saying that this is an awful expression. You should never call anyone a foreign agent, even if he is a foreign agent. And now we have the American media calling a Russian lawyer a foreign agent simply because she met with Jared Kushner and with Donald Trump Jr. And she reportedly could have some negative information about Hillary Clinton.
So does everybody that knows her.
About her from the New York Times, right. From the times when the New York Times was a lot more objective.
Right.
Well, am I a foreign agent if I share it with Jared Kushner? This is all just laughable, but it just shows you how much the United States veered off the Democratic road, and that that detour from the Democratic road happened under Obama. It was encouraged by Obama, prompted by Obama, abetted by Obama, and now they are of course going to say that this is all just because that vulgar man Trump came to power. The hatred of the globalist elite for Donald Trump, the whole problem is that he's not doing anything that they wouldn't do. He's trying to fit their agenda, and that is his mistake, because they will not forget him. They will not forgive him, simply because he was not supposed to be the president. They have chosen, they had chosen a different person. And for them, having someone else than the person that they had chosen become the president, that is unacceptable.
Right. That's right.
So if Obama's strategy is to sit it out, wait until they adapt to the new situation, show his loyalty, and then continue ruling the way Obama did, it's not going to work, because these people, if they choose a victim, the victim could be a country like Iraq or Syria or Libya, or it could be a person like Saddam or Milosevic or now Trump. They simply won't let go. That is their principle. They act in a very concise way. And they destroy the enemy. The problem is that they don't create happy life around themselves, but they definitely destroy the country or the person whom they sentenced to punishment. You know, I should not, and I don't want to idealize the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. My respect for him is based on a very simple principle. He was the first person in the world to say, I'm not afraid. You know, when the globalist elite made it very clear that they wanted to destroy him, that they won't forgive him for his resistance to their plans, he had the courage to stand up and say, I'm not afraid. All the other ones wanted to cut deals. You know, Milosevic tried to cut a deal in Dayton in 1995. Saddam and Gaddafi destroyed their weapons of mass destruction. They were all deceived because there was no goodwill on the other side. So Putin decided to challenge these people, and that is a reason enough to respect him. But we'll see if these people will succeed this time. I don't think they will.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.